The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay. We have a wonderful panel this morning, and it's my job to give the introductions on the speakers, and I'll also have an opportunity to make a few comments after the papers, and then invite you to ask questions. So have some coffee. Wake up. All right. I'd first like to introduce our first speaker is Dan Burke, who is the Oppenheimer, Wolf, and Donnelly Professor at the University of Minnesota, where he teaches patents and copyrights. He has a B.S. in microbiology, an M.S. in molecular biology and biochemistry, and he has law degrees from Arizona and Stanford. He is a prolific writer in the areas of new technologies, internet regulation, competition policy, et cetera, et cetera. He is a prolific writer. Dan Burke is not a woman, but he does damn good feminist theory scholarship, so we're very happy to have him here. We also have today, our second speaker will be Carice Craig, who is an associate professor of law at Osgoode Hall Law School in Toronto, where she teaches copyrights, trademarks, and international IP. She has an LLB from the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, an LLM from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and she's an SJD candidate at the University of Toronto. Her research is primarily in the area of intellectual property with an emphasis upon public interest theory and public domain. And I'm very happy to welcome these two speakers. Thank you.
Well, I am delighted to be back, having had a little bit of a chance to participate in what Peter described to you as the first of these workshops, and it's great to see the project flourishing and maybe be able to contribute to it a little bit this year. The paper that I submitted for this conference and the presentation I'm going to talk with you about for the next few minutes started out as a talk I was asked to give to the Society for Philosophy and Technology about 6 months ago. And so it's making the transition from sort of philosophy format to law format. And as a consequence, it's very much a work in progress, and I'm looking forward to your comments on it. But it tries to engage a problem that has concerned me and puzzled me for some time now, which is the question of dualism in our major forms of intellectual property. There are a number of dualisms in particularly patent and copyright law that I focused on, and I'm going to talk about a couple of them with you here today. It occurred to me because I was invited to be at this early workshop that Peter mentioned and some other projects along these lines that some of the tools that feminist theorists have made available to us are awfully useful in unpacking and thinking about these types of dualism in intellectual property. And so hope to use some of those insights to interrogate some parts of intellectual property law that perhaps we don't think about enough, and maybe we should. Typically, when we talk about at least patents and copyrights, maybe not so much trademarks, although sometimes you hear this about trademarks, and even trade secrecy, we get in the United States consequentialist types of arguments as to why intellectual property is a good thing. That it's a public good and we need to provide incentives and create exclusions, otherwise people will not be interested in creating intellectual property. There are, of course, other theories out there. Some people in the room have written about these. Lockean labor theory, Carice has written about that. That you really deserve a reward for having worked hard to create these copyrightable works or patentable inventions. Some types of personality-based theories, often Hegelian or even Kantian types of deontological arguments that the author or the inventor has invested part of him or herself in the intellectual property, and so we ought to honor that investment. But whichever way you look at this, There are some odd features to the structure of intellectual property in the patent and copyright area that don't seem to fit well with any of those ideas. And this first struck me thinking about patent law. Who is an inventor? You know, what does it mean to be an inventor in our patent law? And inventorship in patent law focuses on and circles about the idea of conception. Now, Peter talked about sort of loaded gendered language. While there's a real doozy there in the patent statute, in order to be an inventor, you have to conceive of the invention. And this is particularly important in the U.S. because we are a first to invent, in fact, the last first to invent jurisdiction. We have this odd, possibly constitutionally required, but we have this odd habit of feeling that we need to give the patent to the first person to have invented the claimed invention. And we determine that on the basis of conception, primarily on the basis of conception. The courts going well back into the 19th and even to some extent to the 18th, but mostly 19th century cases, talk about conception, define conception as the formation in the mind of the inventor of the definite and permanent image of the invention as it thereafter will be reduced to practice. Right? So conception is a mental act in patent law. Now, you still have to, as patent lingo goes, reduce the thing to practice in some way, which typically means actually building or physically instantiating that invention. But reduction to practice in patent law is not terribly important, except to the extent that it bears sometimes on you know, who gets the patent from being the first inventor. It provides a sort of evidence for that. But the materiality part of inventing, the actual working with physical components or with things out of the material world, is considered to be the work of, and again this is a quote, the mere artisan, you know, the person of ordinary skill. Now, an inventor is by definition someone of extraordinary skill, right? That's what makes them an inventor. And once the inventor has had a complete conception of this invention, the complete mental formulation of this invention, then any artisan, any person of skill in the art, once it's been explained to him or her, should be able to reduce the invention to practice, to build the invention. And in fact, we actually formalize this in a legal fiction. When you file a patent, that's considered a constructive reduction to practice because it's assumed that you have described in sufficient detail in that document how to make and use the invention so that the person of ordinary skill could build it. So reduction to practice is sort of an afterthought. You know, so, now, if you've ever actually done any building of anything, you know, if you took shop in high school, or you do any programming, or you like to build model ships or anything else, you know that actually working with physical stuff is tricky. You know, it is in fact difficult, and there are glitches and there are problems that come up in debugging code, or getting those bacteria to work the way you want them to, or building a working model of something. But patent law tells us that that's just because you didn't have a complete conception. You know, if you really understood and had a full formation of how the thing worked, building it is trivial. And if you're discovering problems and little glitches are popping up as you're building it, that's because your conception is not complete, and so you're still in the process of conception. Right? So everything focuses on this creation of the mental image. Even when we have situations where people are joint inventors, you know, where they both have worked on an invention, the question is really, what was the contribution to the conception? Not did you assist in building or making the final product work. So you can't be an inventor, you can't be a joint inventor, you don't get into the inventor's club without doing this. And if you are the technician or the artisan, you are not an inventor even if you worked on building it. Now, we see something very similar when we look at our copyright jurisprudence, which is this idea of the work and the copy. The work which is in fact protected by copyright is this very idealized creation, right? This intangible creative thing, sort of a platonic form out there in the universe of the forms, that then becomes fixed or instantiated in some physical material, in a tangible medium of expression. But that's not really the important part. I mean, that triggers protection, but the thing that's really being protected is the work. And in fact, even the language of copyright, I think Carice may talk about this a little bit more, even the language of copyright sort of signals this, right? You know, the work, the intangible creative thing, that's you know, that was work, right? That was something that is worth protecting. And the physical fixation, those are copies of the work, right? Those are copies of the ideal. This tends to pop up most often when you think about things like the first sale doctrine, where we can actually bifurcate ownership, right? And someone can hold the rights in the copyrighted work, and someone else can hold the rights in the physical instantiation. But it is, in fact, the work that's protected, even when we have works with a single copy, right? What colloquially would be called the original, right? You know, an original oil painting, an original sculpture. In copyright lingo, those are the first copy. Of the intangible thing. So again, there's this focus on the intangible, on the mental aspects of creation, and a real divide that we see in both patent law and copyright law between the physical, the material, and the mental intangible, sort of a classic mind-body type of dualism. In copyright, this hooks into the whole idea of original expression, right? That expression has to originate with the author, not come from somewhere outside. If it's from outside of the author, if it is, in other words, a fact, it's not protectable. And again, in copyright, we see with joint authorship that you've got to have original contributions. We found out last night this differs a bit between Canadian copyright law and U.S. copyright law, but the general thrust seems to still be the same, that you need to contribute some independently copyrightable expression to something in order to be an author. You can't simply execute someone else's expression. And so there are a number of cases dealing with cinematographers and others who somehow carry out the instructions or perform the instructions of the real author. And even though you might think that there was creativity and skill used in doing that filming or executing that particular set of instructions, courts pretty consistently hold, those people aren't authors. They're simply carrying out what they were instructed to do by someone who's a real author, someone who mentally created the work. This fits well with things that Peter and Carice and other folks in the room have written about with regard to the romantic author, this idea going back a couple of centuries that the isolated genius who's inspired is really the person who should be honored. It's true not just in copyright, it's also true in patent law. I mean, sort of the classic heroic inventor, as we call them in patent law, is again the isolated genius, the person working diligently in the basement or the garage to come up with some new gadget that will change the face of civilization, someone of extraordinary skill in the art. In fact, most invention doesn't happen that way. Most research doesn't happen that way, certainly not in a modern setting. Most patents are filed by corporations, and the research is done in large collaborative research groups. Nonetheless, the paradigm is still this lone heroic inventor. Now, if we think about that kind of dualism mental versus physical, sort of valorizing or elevating the mental work in both patent and copyright over the physical. There's a very useful literature in feminist theory critiquing those kinds of dualisms, saying, we have a tendency to do this in Western culture, to separate things out into polar opposites, and to subordinate one of those, or feminize one of those, making one desirable and elevating the one, the other being undesirable and there's a fairly large literature talking about how this is done with regard to mind-body dualism, that the mental work is privileged and is associated with the masculine in these types of dualisms. The physical work, the work of the body, is feminized and subordinated, and we see that all kinds of places in terms of employment, in terms of pay scales and so on. That material work tends to be devalued, and mental work valued more. And our patent and copyright law seems to reflect that. That suggests, at least to me, that some of the literature in feminist critiques on so-called invisible work might be very useful in thinking about what we're doing in patent law and in copyright. I said at the beginning of my presentation that we supposedly have these types of intellectual property to reward and encourage certain types of activities. These feminist tools, I think, are helpful to us in thinking, what are we encouraging and what are we rewarding? And there's, a fairly large literature in the feminist theory on invisible work, work that is done that makes society run, that's important to the maintenance of society, but which goes unrecognized. And typically that lower status, domestic or menial type of work is associated with the body, is associated with corporeality and physical types of labor. People forget that it happens. It's sort of relegated to the background, but nonetheless it's going on. It seems to me that that is also going on, given this mind-body dualism in patent law and copyright law, that there are lots of people who make works and make inventions available, make them function, but those technicians, those mere artisans are relegated to the background. They aren't honored as authors. They aren't honored as inventors. We wouldn't have these creative works and inventions without them. Nonetheless, they disappear. Their work goes mostly unrewarded and is mostly invisible. Now, at the very end of the paper that I submitted, I tossed off sort of a to-be-continued paragraph because, as I said, I presented this 6 months ago under some time and word constraints. And I said, mind-body dualism seems to be important. It seems to be a fertile area to look at, but there's some others that we want to look at, and I want to just hint at one of those, which is the products of nature doctrine. In patent law and its parallel in copyright. As most of you are aware, in the United States, and not so much in Canada, as it turns out, but at least in the United States, we say anything under sun made by man, and that's very gendered, right? So anything under the sun made by humans, perhaps, but maybe really is made by man, should be patentable. It's patentable subject matter. And that has been extended to include living organisms and software and business methods and all kinds of things. In fact, the only real carve-out, the only real holdout to patentability, at least in the U.S., is the so-called products of nature doctrine, that there has to have been some human intervention, there has to have been some change in the material affected by a person. We can't just take things straight out of nature and patent them. It has to be the product of human ingenuity, not the product of nature. And that includes classically mathematics, mathematical equations and formula, expressions of natural law, the Pythagorean theorem and the theory of relativity and the laws of thermodynamics are all sort of classic examples of things that are not supposed to be patentable. Well, that's open to some question, right? Are those the product of human ingenuity or not? Many mathematicians, perhaps most mathematicians, would say that mathematics is a human construct. It's a human language, and it's a way of describing the universe and things that aren't in the universe, and is really the product of human ingenuity. But our patent law assumes it's sort of out there embedded in the fabric of reality independently, and so should not be patentable. the same with scientific laws. Scientific law models of how the universe works change, and they are uniquely human. You know, Jacob Bronowski used to be very fond of driving this point home, that the way that Newton viewed the universe, the way that Einstein viewed the universe are both the products of human creativity. The way that Thomson or Bohr or Heisenberg viewed the atom were very different models, and again, they were all the product of human interpretation, human creativity. Nonetheless, our patent law assumes that those things are out there, part of the fabric of reality, not to be patented. And that raises a real question as to what is natural? Justice Rehnquist pointed this out in a concurrence in Parker versus Fluke. He said, we've got to be really careful with this product of nature, laws of nature doctrine, because ultimately everything that humans do is part of nature and is drawn from nature. It's based on our understanding of how nature works and materials we get from nature. So if you sort of push this product of nature idea too far, either nothing is patentable or everything is patentable. And so it's not clear how much sense that makes. But there's a very clear dualism there between nature and culture that's embedded in our patent law. We see something very similar in copyright. Right? Classically, we say that facts are not copyrightable. Why not? Well, as I said in my previous slide, because they are not the original expression of an author. Right? They are sort of out there. They're outside the author. They exist independently of human creativity. Again, they are sort of embedded in the fabric of reality, and they're discovered. They're not created. They're not original expression. That's, again, a dicey proposition. Most things that we call facts are, in fact, value-laden and interpretive. And there's actually a very interesting literature on things like photography. Right? Remember that at the beginning of the era of the invention of photography, there were questions about, gee, is this really something that is copyrightable? I mean, these photographs, don't they simply show us reality? Aren't they unoriginal? And the answer was no. If you pose Oscar Wilde a certain way, that's a selection that's original, and so that ought to be protectable under copyright. This question as to whether photography is transparent, whether it's really a window on the world, or whether it's more like a text that is interpreted and that is arranged by humans, goes back quite a ways. And we have tended to say nowadays that there's something interpretive there. The same is true with things that are supposedly fact-laden, like maps. There's wonderful literature on how maps, as portrayals of the world, as portrayals of how things exist, are in fact value-laden and tell a particular story. Some interesting articles about how maps are part of empire building. Right? If you want to have an empire, you have to depict the world in a certain way, and most empires have become fascinated with and highly adept at map making, even up to today, where you have the United States, the American Empire, focusing on global satellite cartography and global positioning types of systems, right? Again, that's an expression of a particular power relationship, an expression of a particular view of the world. So all these things tend to be constructed. And it's not entirely clear, is there anything out there in the fabric of reality that we could really call a fact that we would exclude from copyright? Nonetheless, we attempt to do that. We say there are some things that are facts and some things that are expression, and we try and divide what's in nature from what's in culture. Well, the fact that that doesn't work too well, either in copyright or in patent, suggests something else may be going on. And again, there's a famous literature on looking at this dualism between nature and culture. A lot of this you find in ecofeminism, saying, nature is conceived of, again, there's that loaded word, as being feminized. But it's not nice to fool Mother Nature and all those sorts of things, which makes it open to subjugation and open to human appropriation. That if nature is feminine, it's okay to use it. And in fact, if you go back in the scientific literature to very early discussions of modern science, people like Bacon, some of the feminized terminology is quite graphic, sort of bordering on sexual violation and rape types of rhetoric, that we can take what we want from nature and wrest her secrets from her and so on. So the feminist literature points this out. More recently, some people like Anupam Chander and Madhavi Sundar have written about the romance of the public domain, how by leaving certain types of things, natural things or facts, freely available, that makes them open to appropriation and sometimes to over or misappropriation, and creates a particular type of hierarchy as to who is going to get rewarded and who is not. Among other things, going back to this idea of invisible work, you know, those who do industrialized kinds of things, those who do high-tech or first world kinds of work get rewarded under the patent system in particular, to some extent under copyright, whereas those who do low-tech kinds of things, agrarian kinds of things, they don't. You know, they're living close to nature, close to the land, and nature and facts are, of course, not protectable. So they don't get the rewards of the intellectual property system, but people who do different kinds of work, somewhat more removed or what looks more high-tech, do. And again, when we think about a romantic author, how can the author really exist except in opposition to something? And again, I think Carius will talk about this more. And so maybe this is a necessary story that has to be there in order to justify and support the idea of the romantic author. So I leave you with those couple of dualisms and some ways that feminist theory can help us to think about them, interrogate them a little bit. And I look forward to your questions, and I'm looking forward to the next presentation.
While our next speaker takes the podium, I would just like to invite people to come off the stairs, have a seat. We've got plenty of them, so come on in.
Okay, hi everyone. First of all, I just want to start by saying a thank you to the organisers for organising what promises to be a very exciting day and for including me in it. So I'm very pleased to be here, and thanks to Dan for a great talk. And hopefully I'll just be picking up on some of those themes and following through with that. So what I want to talk about today is well, it's actually part of a larger project. The overarching theme of the project is the need for us just generally, when we're talking about copyright, to begin to move away from notions of individual entitlement, of private property, of natural right in copyright law, and to reimagine copyright in terms of cultural policy, thinking about community, thinking about communication as the guiding principles. Now, of course, from a theoretical perspective, we know that copyright law has had much more attention from economic theorists than it has from feminist theorists over recent years. And, of course, we're all too familiar, well, I shouldn't really put it that way, we're all familiar with the economic rationale for copyright, the incentive via the proprietary right. In my opinion, I think perhaps the greatest weakness of this economic rationale is its failure to really capture what we mean or to portray authors or authorship in an appropriate light. So its failure to understand the nature of the very creative process that it is intended to stimulate and to encourage. So my suggestion is what copyright needs is a theory that's capable of grasping the nature and the role of intellectual creativity. So what does it mean to create expression? What does it mean to produce something independently? Why does it even matter? And I think the economic incentive theory alone cannot explain the significance of that creative process, either for the creators themselves or for society in general. So what I aim to do then in my work is to suggest a theoretical framework that I think would be better suited to capturing these themes and so justifying or informing copyright law and policy. Now, in the time that I have today, what I want to do really three things. First of all, I'm going to talk a little bit about the current copyright model and its present theoretical framework. So, in particular then, the construction of authorship that I think has informed the development of the copyright system and that continues to influence our perception of copyright and how it works. And of course, here I'm referring to the notion of authorship as independent creation. And then I'll briefly outline some critiques of that theory that have been found, or that conception of authorship that have been found in literary theory and also more recently in copyright scholarship itself. And then thirdly, and really for what is the bulk of the paper, I want to turn our attention to considering how this concept of authorship might be reconstructed to better suit the creative, or to better describe the creative process and to better reflect the purposes of the copyright system. And it's in this discussion, really, I'm going to be drawing upon some of the lessons of feminist theory, both feminist literary theory and legal theory. So while it's true, then, that intellectual property and copyright have been quite stubbornly immune to feminist critique over the years, I want to chip in here to suggest that there are some feminist theoretical tools out there that might be harnessed to change the shape of copyright law and copyright policy. Okay, so I think my starting point for the project really is my sense that there's a connection between how we understand the author in copyright law and how we understand the nature of the human self more generally. So that underpinning these themes I'm going to be discussing is a concern that copyright in general is structured around the assumptions of liberal possessive individualism. So private property, private rights, ownership, exclusion, these are the key ingredients of possessive individualism, and they're also the key ingredients of copyright law, which means that our focus in copyright tends to be upon either individual entitlement, where we're thinking about the author as the owner of natural rights, or if not that, then at least economic rationality and self-interest, where we think about the individual author as responsive to financial incentive. And my suggestion then is that this current theoretical framework in copyright is reflected in the form that the author takes in copyright theory. So the author becomes then the independent creator and the proprietor. Now, of course, there are several influential works over recent years that have shown how historically contingent this concept of the author is, emerging out of a particular time in history. But we've also seen that it's very much ideologically contingent. So in the 18th century, our perception of authorship converged with an emerging political philosophy, the Enlightenment era, the shift towards individualism. And it's in that context that the writer became recast as the author in the sense of the originator or the creator. And from this as well emerged the romantic distinction between imitation and originality. And that distinction between originality and imitation is something that would have been alien to the classical period, where really imitation was the aesthetic norm or ideal. And then, of course, we had the literary theory of the 20th century, which completely dismantled this version of the author. We had Foucault, we had Barthes declaring the death of the author, or at least this romantic conceptualization of the author. And this literature was aimed at undermining our belief in creative originality, making us question the idea of an individual with control over the meaning of text. And so text was then reconceived as being necessarily a reproduction of other texts. The process of creation was one of translating, recombining, mixing, as Jessica Littman has said, what is already out there. And I think perhaps the most important thing about this is that it reveals that there's nothing natural or essential about any particular definition we might want to give to the idea of the author. And so this then gives us some space to ask about what Foucault called the author function. What function does this individualized account of authorship present? And here again, copyright scholars took up the challenge, suggesting that individual origination facilitates the idea of the author as proprietor, so that origination and appropriation in that sense really go hand in hand. Now, it's been suggested, and I tend to agree, that in copyright law it's almost as though the 20th century just didn't happen. So copyright remains kind of rooted in this idea of the modern, the individualized, the romantic author, and for that reason it fails to sufficiently recognize that culture is a process of accretion or of evolution and not simply of independent creation. Now, it's true, of course, that copyright law is not concerned with questions of genius or quality or even really creativity in any traditional sense. The typical copyright owner is very far removed from the romantic genius. But I'd suggest really that the further away he is, the more work the romantic rhetoric seems to do in order to bridge that gap, so that the ideals of individual origination are ingrained in the rhetoric of authorship and the rhetoric of copyright, and then we protect copyrightable works as though their creator's reality lived up to this rhetorical ideal. And we've seen as well the way that this author figure then has been harnessed as a political tool, as a way of expanding the subject matter of copyright, the scope of copyright. So in the computer software debates of the 70s, we saw the... I was a baby. We saw... I've heard that the... computer programmer was kind of recast as the virtuoso of the modern age. And then we do see now in the peer-to-peer file debates, we see constantly the invocation of this struggling, deserving artist as the reason why copyright must be respected and protected. But the implications for copyright policy are really even larger than that, because what this whole idea evokes is essentially what is a moral divide. So we end up with the creator pitted against the copier, the author against the imitator, the owner against the infringer. And if it's true that authorship is really a process of accretion or evolution, then these dichotomies seem to mischaracterize that creative process. And then the consequence, I think, is that we have a system that has the potential then to exclude or even to silence authorship that falls on the wrong side of one of these binary oppositions. So anything from postmodern art, appropriation art, to music sampling, to satire, anything that's a derivative and transformative use of a protected work tends to look more like infringement than it does like authorship. And if we accept that these things are or can be valuable contributions to a postmodern culture like ours, then we have to recognize that they're challenging the very structures and assumptions of copyright law, because they seem to threaten copyright's ability to perform its function. Okay, now, so of course these themes, themes of romantic authorship and its implications for copyright have been explored in the work of various copyright scholars, some of whom are of course in the room today. So all I really wanted to do here was to, in a sense, reiterate or remind you of why it is that the reimagination of copyright law should or certainly could begin with the deconstruction of this central figure of the author as owner. But now we reach the question of how we can reconstruct that author figure to better suit copyright's purposes, the reality of creative expression. And here, as I've suggested, there's a particular vision of the self that's informed by liberal theory, that's the isolated, independent bearer of rights, the owner of property, that underlies copyright's vision of the author self. And so the problem for copyright that's been identified here is that this vision of the self tends to undermine the role of communities and of society in the creative process, the communities and society in which the author exists and from which the author must necessarily draw in order to create. So creativity is socially situated in that sense. And then the challenge to copyright becomes, how does it acknowledge that there's nothing absolutely original, that culture does grow by accretion, while retaining something that resembles an author figure, which copyright needs? And it's for this reason that I found myself in my work drawing upon feminist theory. So to explain that, feminists, like many other critical scholars of the last half century, have been attacking the sort of fundamental assumptions of possessive individualism, the notion of selfhood that's central to liberalism. But the feminist political project requires, at the end of all this, something that looks like an autonomous, rights-bearing self. Okay, so for that reason, they've resisted, for example, communitarianism, because it kind of wipes out the agency of the self. And I think, in this sense, copyright faces a similar challenge, because for copyright to give up on the idea of an individual author would be for copyright to give up on its own political project. In a sense, it would signal copyright's demise. So unlike traditional or unlike literary theory, copyright theory cannot afford to completely disaggregate the author. It can't afford to discard the idea of the author. But even more than that, there's definitely something about this idea, something about the notion of creativity, individuality, ability, that we're unwilling to discard. And I think that's been evidenced by the fact that even after all of this so-called deconstruction of the last few decades, the modern author is still very much alive and well. So what I want to do then is to consider some of the tools and the concepts that feminists have employed in order to resolve what is essentially a dilemma in this sense. And the starting point for this is to note that feminist theory has taught us, as Dan pointed out, that we have to begin by collapsing liberalism's dichotomies. So this, the false dilemmas. Feminists have taught us that the self can be both at once socially situated, socially constituted, and also an autonomous and independent agent. So what feminists have taught us then is what we need to find is a fuller account of agency and of rights in the context of communities and relationships. And I think they've done this most effectively in what tends to be categorized as relational feminism. So it's upon relational feminism that I'm going to draw. In particular, I look at the work of Jennifer Nadelsky. But the two ideas I want to use here, first of all, the role or the idea of the relational self. And secondly, the role or the idea of dialogue. And this concept of dialogue is going to lead me into discussions as well of literary theory. So beginning then with relational feminism, the starting point there is that the truly autonomous and independent self is not isolated or completely independent, but should instead be understood as being situated and interdependent. And that's actually the basis of genuine autonomy. And then connected to that, we have the notion that rights are relational, by which is meant rights should be understood in the context of the relationships that they structure, the relationships that they represent. And then what flows from this as well is that rights should be recognized as affirmations of the kind of social values that we have, the kind of relationships, social relations to which we aspire. So using these core concepts, the question becomes, how can these inform copyright theory? And I think we can start with the idea of a relational author. Okay, so we can think about the author as being socially embedded, as creating necessarily out of the discourses, the texts, the images that surround her. But we can also recognize something like a creative capacity, so that the materials of authorship are given in that sense, but the authorship itself is this process of interpretation and reinterpretation and re-presentation. So, in other words, relational feminist theory can help us to see that intellectual expression is at once a process of creation and of evolution or accretion. And then also we can have a relational account of copyright as an institution. So we can maybe see more clearly that copyright as an institution creates rights And in doing that, it structures relationships between citizens. And then we can begin to think about those relations as relations of communication or exchange between members of society, between the author and the public. And finally, we can think about the rights that copyright gives as affirmations then of the social values that we attach to this cultural exchange of expression and ideas. Okay, so that's relational theory. Then I think a second idea that has emerged out of this theory is a focus upon dialogue. So sometimes you see references to dialogic feminism. The language of Nikki Lacey and Elizabeth Fraser in the UK is dialogic communitarianism. But the general theme here is that we must place an emphasis then upon discourse, upon narrative, essentially upon participation and voice, so that dialogue is seen to shape relationships and to shape identities. And also dialogue is a way to challenge social structures, social discourses. And given copyright subject matter, it's interesting to see that a similar focus upon dialogue has emerged in feminist literary theory in the face of what is essentially a similar challenge. So to explain that, feminist literary criticism has tended as well to reject the idea of the dominant author figure, the highly individuated author, which is seen by feminists to be paternal, so that the solitary genius is gendered. It's a solitary male genius. But on the other hand, feminist literary critics have also faced a dilemma in that the completely fragmented author of post-structuralism denies the subjectivity, denies the agency of the speaker or the author. So when Foucault asked, what does it matter who is speaking? The feminist response to that was, well, of course it matters who is speaking if who is speaking is a woman. And it matters because women have been denied the voice to speak or have been denied the authority that comes with the title of author. So only those who have secure and fixed identities have the luxury of fragmenting them. So the literary debate in literary and also in artistic and music theory as well has been between feminists who want to recover or reclaim the woman's voice, the woman's authority, the woman's authenticity, and those who are fearful and would rather agree with the postmodern deconstruction of what they see as a patriarchal author figure. So again, we have this dilemma. And then some theorists, in particular I've looked at the work of Laurie Finke, have argued that the dilemma can be resolved or broken down, again, using the notion of dialogue. Or in literary theory, dialogism or dialogicality sounds a little bit more fancy. I think essentially it's the same thing. They're talking about how expression should be understood as the interplay or the struggle of meaning, so that every utterance exists only in relation to other utterances. Nothing is independent, nothing is original in that sense. But still it matters who is speaking. It doesn't matter because the speaker is original or authoritative. It matters because discourse is socially situated. Discourse is historically situated. And this process of discursive engagement itself is constitutive of subjectivities, of identities, of social relations. Okay, so then the question becomes, how can this concept of dialogue or dialogicality inform copyright theory? And here I just suggest that a dialogic account of authorship that embraces these insights will allow us to see the author not as the source or the origin or the authority on meaning, but as a participant or as a citizen. So the authorship then becomes not a single unitary act, but rather a process of engaging in what is an ongoing social dialogue, responding to texts and discourses already out there. So basically what it allows us to do in copyright theory is to learn the lessons of post-structuralist critiques of the author while retaining something like an author figure for copyright's purposes. Okay. So the remaining question, I think, then is what might be the legal or doctrinal implications of reimagining the author in these terms? I think first at an overarching level, it allows us to reimagine copyright as a tool of cultural policy and essentially a speech regulation. So we can see that its purpose must be to enhance cultural relations of communication by encouraging authorship, by encouraging this kind of participation and engagement in the social evolution or the social dialogue. It also requires us to reject then, I think, fundamentally, the idea of copyright as a system whose purpose is the protection of individual property owners. And then in terms of doctrinal implications, there are many, so just maybe to outline them are some that I might foresee. First of all, I think the originality doctrine may look very different with this theory of the author. So that originality as a concept, again, will survive because it must if we were to have a copyright system. But we can begin to think about redefining originality with reference to the kinds of intellectual expression or the kinds of engagement that we want to encourage, and respecting authorship as being a dialogic and cumulative process. And then I think as well, and perhaps most importantly, infringement might look very different. So we might want to rein in, for example, the power of copyright owners to control derivative uses of protected works, so that transformative works, works that use protected expression to communicate new meaning, and these will be recognized as new contributions to cultural dialogue and encouraged as such. Which also means that the fair use defense might be expanded to ensure that transformative uses of material will be permitted and not silenced, so that the overarching concern there will not be protecting owners' commercial interests, but rather allowing and facilitating that kind of expressive engagement. Finally, I think copyright would have to be more sensitive to the free speech interests of users of protected works, in recognition of the fact that copyright and free speech, the right of free speech, reflect the same social values, and both of them involve an attempt to structure relations of communication. Okay, so just finishing up then, I think in general what this reimagined model will allow us to do is to remove this undue emphasis upon the author as rights bearer and reimagine the author as a communicator, while also allowing us to appreciate that others, users of cultural products, are also engaged in a communicative process. So then we need to recognize the need for room within this legal framework to allow for these dialogic processes, to allow for that kind of intellectual engagement, so that there's room for learning, for responding, for sharing, and users are not just portrayed as passively consuming intellectual products. So intellectual property and copyright, I guess to conclude here, do operate like any other area of law within a larger theoretical, ideological, and, of course, political framework. And I think that this perception of a clear line between creation and imitation, between author and user, is a perfect example of how ideological assumptions can come to inform and define legal constructs. So by using feminist tools of analysis and critique, we can begin to challenge these underlying assumptions. And then we have a better chance, I think, of developing a copyright system that's actually equipped to encourage, rather than to obstruct, the very kinds of creative activities that contribute to the ongoing exchange of meaning that copyright law should further. Okay, thank you for your time today.
I hate to follow someone with a beautiful accent. I really should have had Dan speak second. That was a mistake.
You both have beautiful accents.
I really want to thank both of you for sharing these papers with us. I had immense joy in reading them, and I'm very happy that they're a part of this conference. The papers themselves are beautifully written, and I just want to congratulate both of you for doing such big projects in a short amount of space and synthesizing so much work, interdisciplinary work at that. I'm going to attempt to kind of say a few things that might put the papers in dialogue, I guess. In a sense, both papers talk to us about dualisms. Most obviously, Dan's paper talked about the mind-body dualism. And I guess Carrie's paper talked about the origination-imitation dualism, most prominently. These papers remind us that these paradigms don't map onto reality very well. Instead, these paradigms, in fact, mask reality and have some negative effects. Some of these effects are to inaccurately distribute rights. I think we saw that most clearly in Dan's paper. They cause us to devalue what are usually seen as feminized traits of work, of the work, and of the labor in the production of creating works. They cause us to incorrectly value work, inventions, discoveries themselves. And in fact, they may not have the desired effect to incentivize behaviors that we'd like to incentivize through the intellectual property system. So I wonder about the project of deconstructing these paradigms and where that leads us if we deconstruct the author, if we deconstruct the mind-body dualism. What would the effect be? I wondered this from Dan's paper, what would happen if the law recognized what he termed invisible work? What would be the practical effect of that? Would we have more patents issued? Would we have more monopolies? And would that be a good thing? Carrie's acknowledged this a little bit in her paper when she said this deconstruction might lead to the demise of the copyright system, which she thought may not be a good thing, I guess. But both of these papers recognize that these paradigms offer us a convenient ruse, offer the intellectual property system a convenient ruse for the location and assignment of rights, for the requirements of the creation of rights. And they also remind us that these paradigms have really taken hold. They seem to have intuitive appeal, and they outlast any critique. It made me recall that recently I took my kids to the Museum of the American Indian for a performance of tribal song and dance. And there were some introductions to these performances that really made me wonder, because we were told that these songs and these dances were very traditional and that they were being performed with adherence to the traditional rules of the songs and dance. But at the end, they were credited in a way that was surprising to me. Some young person would be pointed out as the owner of the song. And I wondered how they could both be so traditional and authentic and also be assigned ownership to an individual. And I wonder, given what we've heard from these papers today, whether that owner would have discovered them or would have been in dialogue with them or would have done something else, made concrete these songs, which may have been, you know, in the mind only. Whether there is some alternative ways of having the kind of practicality of an assignment of rights without maintaining this traditional paradigm. The speakers demonstrate for us that feminist theory can make important contributions to the field of intellectual property and have thus earned their airfare here in doing that today. Feminist theory allows us to acknowledge this ruse for what it is, and thereby allows us to expose its detrimental effects and to offer different solutions. Dichotomies are attractive because they seem to offer this simplistic truth. But in their simplicity, they don't always work so well at all times. And so I think we see in their examples in both of the papers where these dichotomies or these authorship constructs kind of have ebbs and flows in the development of intellectual property law. They come on very strongly at times, and they conveniently recede at other times. And it's at these points where they emerge and disappear that they're really doing their work. And it's at these points that we have an opportunity to offer alternatives that we can get from feminist theory. So I want to thank these speakers for the hope that they've given us for this feminist project for intellectual property. And I think it's been a great start to this conference because they've given us a real foundation for this project. And I know from the abstracts that we'll be seeing some specific implementation of this project later through the day. So I want to again acknowledge the great contribution from these speakers and to ask for your questions. And we'll have time to entertain your questions for about a half an hour, and then we'll have lunch. Thank you.
Rebecca? Yeah.
I think we're actually podcasting, if I understand correctly. So. Then it doesn't really matter, does it?
Yeah.
I think that's helpful in a number of respects. First of all, let me cheerfully acknowledge, with regard to Rebecca's first point, that a lot of the material, a lot of the literature that I'm drawing on in my paper is at the intersection of feminism and Marxism. That's a Marxist feminist critique. So that may be your next project, Peter, is the Marxist Marxism and IP, the unmapped connections, which in fact is Dan Hunter has a paper in that direction at this point, and there's actually a lot to be said there. But yes, there's a clear class question that arises, and feminists have talked about that from a particular standpoint. I don't know exactly how much of the unpaid, invisible, low-paid, subordinated labor in these industries is actually done by females. Laura Heyman pointed out to me a couple of years ago that coming out of the publishing industry, gee, it seemed like a lot of editors and copy editors, whatever, in the publishing industry were women. And they do all kinds of things to make books that get published look, like someone who want to read them, but never get acknowledgement. So, it's not clear to me how many of the gaffers and best boys and lighting specialists and studio musicians and recording engineers and all the other folks who work on making creative products come to the marketplace are women, but at least they are feminized in the way that you point out. That relates, I think, to your comments about Christine's comments, which I thought were really helpful. One of the things I like so much about Carrie's paper is that it has a very positive agenda. My jurisprudence prof back when I was in law school, talked about feminist critiques and critical legal studies as being sort of whiny versions of legal realism. It's like, there are all these problems, so what? I actually do think that's valuable. I mean, in writing the paper, one of the things that I thought the tools of feminist theory were useful for is pointing out, what are we exactly doing? What are these sort of unanticipated and unappreciated effects of our intellectual property system? And maybe we want to do that and maybe we don't, but a lot of the time we don't know that it's there, and so sort of surfacing those effects is worthwhile. But if you can then go past that, for example, in the way that Carrie is suggesting, and say, okay, and here's what we might replace it with, that's a big step forward. Now, Christine made mention of the Museum of the American Indian and essentially other cultural models that are out there. There's a little bit of work that's been done on that. My colleague Ruth O'Kennedy has done some. I've done a little bit as well. There are, in fact, models of proprietorship and stewardship for folklore and traditional types of cultural objects, where you it might fit with what Carrie is talking about, where you have responsibility for what we would call in the West intellectual property, a cultural property, but it's not yours. It belongs to the community, or it's part of a tradition, and so you maintain it. Perhaps you improve it. Perhaps you embellish on it, but you realize that it's not yours, and that you're going to pass it on to the next generation or pass it on to someone else. So those kinds of models do exist. But as I said in a completely different recent paper, those are being wiped out very quickly. It's sort of like a foreign species being introduced into ecosystems. And the dominant Western model, really models, right, both the utilitarian kind of consequentialist model that I mentioned and the deontological models I mentioned, are rapidly wiping those out all over the world. So one of the things that may be valuable about the discussion here and about some of the tools of feminist critique is being able to either preserve or resurrect some of those other models in the way that Carius is trying to do. And I think that's enormously valuable.
Thank you. I'd just like to thank you, first of all, for the second comment you made about performances and so on. It's something that I haven't really explored, but it does strike me as something that could be an important consequence of thinking about or reimagining authorship in this way, so that the divide between neighbouring rights and classic copyright seems to dissipate when we realise that authorship itself is an interpretative process and it's engaging with existing texts. So when we take a focus away from creativity, we see that that line between performance, between recording, and between authorship itself is a very thin one.
Let me just interject, since we probably have U.S. students in the audience, you might want to give a quick definition of neighboring rights, because not all of us are as international as we should be.
We're always stumbling upon these moments. We're like, oh, is that what you do? Okay, so, I mean, in Canada we have this... really, we do the same thing as the US does, I believe, in terms of we bundle everything under the heading of copyright in the end. So it's broadcasters' rights, sound recording rights, and performance rights as are called copyright in the Canadian Act. But we tend to refer to them as neighbouring rights. And this really flows from a civilian understanding of these rights. So the civil law jurisdiction is based upon this idea of authorship and creativity that flows from the investment of individual personality in the work are quite attached to the distinction between true authorship, which is creative originality, is reflective of an individual personality, and merely performing or broadcasting or recording works that have been created by others. So when you focus upon that divide between authorship and everything else in the civil law context, you really see why performance rights are sort of devalued in this sense. And in the international treaties, you see it. We have a separate convention for neighbouring rights, they're given a different title because it does tread in that line between a sort of utilitarian understanding of what copyright is and one that's rooted in the civilese tradition and personality rights. So once you move away from this rights-based focus, this focus upon creativity, that divide does seem to collapse, and there does seem to be a better cause for understanding all of these rights as a species of essentially the same thing. So that's very helpful to me. The other thing I wanted to just pick up on is the role of copyright as an economic incentive after everything I've said. And certainly I've been accused in the past of basically proposing a theory of copyright that does ultimately lead us to the conclusion that we shouldn't have copyright. And I never really argue against that, because maybe deep down I think it might be true. however, I'm in the process, as it was remarked in the introduction, of trying to defend a dissertation, and so I'll keep that to myself for now. I do think that there is potentially, at least to the extent that I accept that copyright should exist, and that it does have a purpose or a social goal that can justify it in some sense. My challenge has been, or the challenge I've given myself, is to say, well, what are the limits? What does copyright look like if it's true to that justification? So trying to understand what that justification is and why the incentive is needed and what it is we're trying to incentivize. So I've said before, there's a moment in this paper where I can kind of invite the economists back into the room. You know, what I'm really saying is they can't provide us with the normative framework. They can't explain what it is about authorship that's so important to the speaker, so important to society. But maybe what they can do is say, well, okay, if this is what you want to encourage, then we'll tell you how to do that. We'll tell you how to structure a system to create the appropriate incentives. But I think we need something else to give a normative justification of why it is we want to incentivize that kind of activity.
And let me just take a minute to defend myself, Rebecca, as this may be on your blog later, so I want to make sure. I guess if you interpreted my comment to be an endorsement of an economic theory of copyright, then that's wrong. I only meant to suggest that if the system is built on this incentive theory, and actually, as Carrie's paper really nicely points out, with lots of examples and support, there's no the doctrine doesn't match the theory of high romantic author genius, right? Much less is required for protection. So if we want to incentivize that low level creation, why does the romantic author serve us? And certainly if we want to go beyond that and incentivize all of the other kinds of production that Dan and Carrie's talked about, then that high ideal doesn't serve us very well. So that's just taking the economic theory at its face, not endorsing it in any way, but if people believe that it offers an incentive structure, then it doesn't make sense to limit it in that way. Anne.
We don't want to have formalities tripping people up, right? And so we
Well, let me sort of jump in here, and I don't know if this would be Christine's response or not, but I guess we don't know whether we underproduce feminist objects. Coming at this, I was sort of cut my teeth academically speaking in science policy. Right, there's a long-standing debate about the grant-making process in science. You know, does it distort scientific investigation so that we investigate and develop knowledge about, you know, whatever the NSF or NIH thinks is important this year, rather than about other things which could be important, but we completely miss them because those aren't what the NIH or NSF want to focus on. And the same question has begun to be asked of the patent system, right? You know, does the patent system, by having certain criteria for subject matter and also for non-obviousness and utility and novelty and so on, does it distort the inventive process by causing us to focus on things that are too high-tech, things that are too, technically sophisticated, at the expense of other things that aren't? Jerry Reichman has started writing about this, with regard to sub-patentable innovation. And we can think of some fairly obvious examples, right? If we sort of look at the North-South divide, right, there are very creative people out, you know, doing things with traditional remedies and, neem seeds and things like that in India. If you're going to patent that, you know, you sort of take it into the laboratory, you extract the particular chemicals that give you that effect, the sort of pharmaceutical innovation is enormously expensive, right? And you really need a patent in the pharmaceutical industry, to recoup the hundreds of millions of dollars that you invested. Well, you know, if it's just as good to crush some seeds, make a little paste out of them or whatever. Maybe that works better in a low-tech environment in the developing world. We're starting to think, do we need to employ all of the massive investigatory apparatus of Western science to get somewhat longer lifespan, somewhat better health, somewhat better nutrition in the developing world? It's not clear that we do. So it's entirely possible that we may be distorting things, and maybe this is true in copyright as well, but patent, it's fairly obvious to me. We may be distorting investigations in ways by offering this that we don't need to, and sometimes the problem is you don't see what you don't know. Right, we don't know if we're losing that. And again, I think that some of the feminist critique that we're talking about today is useful in surfacing those things that we just wouldn't think about otherwise.
I guess I have the same response, which is I was only meaning to take on the system on its own slogan of incentive theory, right? Not to buy into that theory. You could be right, and I think we'll actually hear a lot more about this in the papers later today about what, if there is any positive effect, if there could be a negative effect for coming into the world of intellectual property in these feminized realms or not. But if intellectual property thinks that it's incentivizing all kinds of production, then this paradigm model doesn't serve it very well, and that's all I meant to say. If, the big if. Anne Bartow.
Oh, okay. I have a different question. It's actually a very different question, but Rebecca's question made me think of it. So this is just, have you thought about, and actually this would even include Christine because I know you've written about photography. My focus of this question is primarily on visual arts rather than textual arts, although it may work there too. I haven't thought that through. And that has to do with why there isn't an intellectual property right for the subject of art. If you think about painting, who gets painted? Right? It's always women and naked women primarily, or, you know, they're the school of naked women or just women with clothes on. But, I mean, women are fairly substantially the majority of the folks who get objectified in painting. It's also true in photography, art photography, and certainly fashion photography. It is true in movies and any audiovisual work. I think culturally we are much more focused on what women look like than what men look like. Even things that even aren't really, you wouldn't even think of as art forms. I mean, if you go to a basketball, college basketball game or football team, I mean, no disrespect to the male cheerleaders, but my What I've noticed from going to a lot of college basketball games is the women tend to be very beautiful and the men tend to be very ordinary looking. There's nothing wrong with that. But in terms of what our standard of what a cheerleader looks like, you know, the women have to be beautiful. For celebrities, you know, if you kind of follow out what they need to look like, you know, men can get by with 10 pounds a lot more readily and with a lot less criticism in any audiovisual medium, so on and so forth. When we talk about like a right of publicity, we want, you know, we don't usually want any part of that. Intellectual property rights never want to give it, you know, Oscar Wilde even doesn't get any right or any say when we decide that there are copyrights in photographs. And I guess what I'm getting at is if you thought about, you know, sort of a gendered aspect to that at all in terms of the objects of copyrighted works.
I'm just speaking completely off the cuff here. I think that if Caris were to invite the economists back into the room at this point, you know, Posner or Easterbrook or Epstein would say, well, the solution to that is contract, right? I mean, you know, if you're Oscar Wilde or whoever, and someone's going to take your photograph, you know, there needs to be a release, and you need to insist that you have some rights in what's produced before that gets produced. Now, that then leads us back to the discussion that we've been having, which is not everyone is Oscar Wilde, right? Not everyone has the economic or personality or other type of leverage to get that type of contract. So we start to stray over into a feminist critique of contract, which I think is entirely appropriate. To pull it back to intellectual property, if you want to think of intellectual property as a set of default rules, you know, we may think it's fine to contract, and we may think everyone's an autonomous, competent adult, you know, able to engage in contracts, but where you allocate the rights in the first place is important. You know, Coase tells us you get a totally different outcome if you allocate the rights to Oscar Wilde in the first instance than if you allocate the rights to the photographer in the first instance, and then let the bargaining begin. So one of the things that the feminist discussion might lead us to here is, all right, where do we want to allocate the initial rights? And then, as Kerry says, we can invite the economists back in the room and tell us what's going to happen when you start to bargain from that point.
I think just to maybe add a little bit of a comparative perspective, since I'm the token international speaker in the room. But it might be interesting, again, it's off the cuff, I haven't really thought about it in those terms, and it's certainly interesting to me to think about the gendered implications of that. But it has been the law in Canada for many years that the person who commissions a photograph or a portrait is the first owner of the copyright therein if valuable consideration is paid. And so that has been the law, and it is in a sense to give the copyright to the person who's the subject and to protect their rights or interests in it, and also the sense that they're usually the inspiration behind it, they're the innovator, it's their idea in a sense that leads to the final expression, and so they could be attributed with the origin of the work in that sense. But what's interesting is that in the most recent legislative changes, this provision is going to be repealed. So the bill that's currently before Parliament has changed, so we don't know what's happening to it, but the first thing it did was say, well, we have to treat photographers like and portrait painters like we treat any other real artist. And the first way to do that is to make sure that they're the owner of the copyright in their works. And what's interesting is they have a small exception in there which allows the subject of the portrait or photograph or the commissioner to make a private use of the work that they've commissioned. But that's really a defence or a permissive licence. It's not any affirmative right that they have. So they have no control over what the photographer or the portrait painter might do with their copyright interests and with the photograph. So it's certainly interesting to see the way that has developed in Canada and to think about it in those terms.
If I could just add one short point about that. I think it's an excellent question, Anne. It's really interesting. As you may know, some of the early photographers who were really instrumental in creating the copyright doctrines that dealt with photography were really celebrity photographers. And they were making their reputation in part based on who they were photographing. So it was very important to have these celebrity images and these particular personalities in front of their camera. But those celebrities were also making their reputation based on who was taking their picture. So, you know, this might have been in another world, this might be viewed as some kind of joint authorship. And there was one particular dispute with a woman celebrity who was trying to get rights over the photograph but the photographer won. And it was because of, you know, exactly what Carrie's writing about, the kind of location of the rights being in that individual who is creating from nothing what is before the camera. And, you know, it's funny that Dan mentioned fruit. You know, there's women and there's also fruit, because really I think that was the theory, that whatever is in front of the camera is like a still life that you kind of create. And there was no acknowledgement that the human that you were posing had any role in what was evoked, either the expression, the costume, the scenery, which tended to be from their famous roles anyway, but that credit was all given to the photographer, who is male. There was one famous early woman photographer, and interestingly, her subject matter tended to be mothers and children, at, or women who weren't celebrities, but they were very feminized kind of scenes and subjects.
Just to follow up for a moment that Anne's fascinating suggestion, because, of course, the only context in which the right of the photographic subject has actually been extensively litigated is that of claims against photo finishers for the unauthorized reproduction of school photographs, in which the photo finisher's defense was a defense of authorization from, not literally the subjects, but the parents, in particular, the mothers of the subjects, who had invested so much prior effort in dressing, combing, and otherwise organizing their children for the big occasion. And that was, of course, dismissed doubly. Vicki knows all about this, both because it was a sort of an affront to the notion of the sole individual photographic creator, and also because it represented an attempt to make visible the invisible work that we've been discussing here today. It's an amazingly good doubt. Which leads me then to a question, which is, although I'm very sympathetic to the notion of looking beyond the dualisms that Dan articulated and looking beyond the historically constructed author figure as Karis looked forward to, I mean, there's an argument at least that in fact we are moving in the other direction, and that doctrinally we are slipping further and further into the grip of this masculinized author figure, at least in copyright law. I don't know so much about patent and invention. So I would be very interested if any of you would like to comment, either from a U.S. law or a comparative law perspective, on recent developments in the law of joint works.
It was one of the things that actually struck me when Dan was speaking, was that a lot could be brought from that paper into our understanding of what is joint authorship. And I think our tendency, our almost of necessity to individualize that process of authorship is what leads to the invisibility of participants in the creative process. So it's interesting that actually, I know you have the Childress and Taylor decision in the States, and what the position in Canada now is that we've just sort of blindly endorsed the Childress test. And it was actually a famous case of Sarah McLachlan, the singer-songwriter, having been working in a studio. So I guess it doesn't really work very well for today, because the guy who was discounted, his contribution was discounted, was indeed a guy, a man. And Sarah McLachlan was the worthy author come owner of the final song. But interestingly, what happened was that we got to the stage where the court had said, yes, there was an intent for the contributions to merge into a unitary whole. Yes, there was an independently copyrightable expression. So yes, you're an author in every sense, except that you're not a joint author, because Sarah McLachlan never thought you were. So I'd much prefer the position of the British courts in the Hodgson's case, or the case about the violinist in the music studio who did contribute some worthy expression and was recognized as having done so, and they dismissed the Childress approach and dismissed the relevance of intent, saying that intent had no bearing upon who was and who was not an author.
let me make a comment, I guess, since I sort of injected the patent aspect into this, and Peter mentions this, that at least in the United States, Congress has become increasingly aware that the heroic inventor is causing problems for patentable research, because in fact most research is done in teams, and we have in patent law the concept of the inventive entity, right, which can be a single individual or it could be a group of individuals who are responsible for the development of a claimed invention. And of course, since group entities can overlap in their membership, you then have various problems with regard to novelty and non-obviousness, because group A knew about this invention that group B was working on because Sally was a member of both group A and group B and can sometimes anticipate her own work. So Congress has gone back and tried to amend the statute relatively recently to deal with this, but mostly because it's screwing up corporations. They say, no, we've got all these people working on research, and we keep shooting ourselves in the foot with regard to getting a patent because we have people in the corporation working on it. Now, I'm not sure which direction that points. Right? Is this, we're sort of moving away, in some senses, from the heroic inventor, but instead we're moving towards the corporate entity, the corporate ownership. And that's not terribly well theorized. I mean, there's a very, very small literature on the deontological rights of corporations, but we haven't thought very seriously about what corporations mean as a juridical person. I suspect that if we apply the tools of feminist theory, we will find that the corporation as a juridical person is pretty masculine. And has a number of the hidden attributes that we've talked about, and perhaps undesirable attributes that we've talked about. But that's that leads to, I think, a very interesting conversation, again, from both Marxist and feminist critique of the corporate entity.
Just to follow up on the patent law stuff and then a couple of additional comments and then a direction for both of your papers, which I think you might push on a little farther. Probably the most hopeful development was by that great feminist jurisprude on the Federal Circuit, Judge X, who I can't remember and can't get on a Westlaw right now to check, who developed the idea of simultaneous conception and reduction to practice.
That would be Judge Lurie.
Thank you.
the great feminist theorist, Judge Lurie, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. And there, what you have is a recognition that for some technologies, the mechanical work is integral to the nature of the conception that recognizes the invention. The problem is, of course, there's no definition of what invention is in the Act. No one's theorized it since, you know, a long time ago in Hotchkiss, which then leads me to my question about Platonic forms. And if you go back in the history, there's at least some useful language about the idea of the invention, even better, the principle of the invention. And I guess my question, therefore, in that regard is, to what extent is this not about dualism so much as it is about linguistic theory of what the nature of a concept is distinct from its application? And is there some way to get past the dualism using feminist theory to get to the idea of things when things have both physical reproduction and conceptual extension that we need to define in categories? Then I go back to this invisible work thing. There's a terrific or awful, I guess, recent case, Stern versus Columbia, where this lab worker, student lab worker, does an experiment at the direction of his supervisor, and they find that there's no contribution to the conception, saying he simply carried out an experiment previously done by the supervisor on different animals. And, you know, I just came back from Paris where they're rioting in the streets. I just don't see student lab workers of the world uniting if we all of a sudden say, you know, this is the feminist critique says that you're being devalued in your inventive contributions here. So it's helpful, but you know, at some point you get back to politics. Even if you get the right, they'll just ask for you to sign it away when you go to the lab. So it doesn't get you very far. I guess the last thing, which I think is really the most interesting and the most productive direction, and I want to encourage you to think some more about it, is this concept from, Hegelian world spirit, perhaps, of collective activity that's not being generated by the inventive contribution of an individual. I used to like structuralism, but leaving that aside, there's some concept of a collectivity that is at work in various ways. And I guess my question is how could one use that much more productively to attack some of the difficult issues, like you just mentioned, the loss of biodiversity-related traditional knowledge, where it's absolutely clear that the doctrinal analysis and the rhetorical analysis would really benefit from both the feminist critique and from other conceptions of collective work as collective mentality, I guess is the best way to put it.
How are we doing on time?
Well, I think we have to make this the last question, unless we have time for a really... Is that a question, Josh, or is that just a...
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
We'll talk about more later. Very briefly, Judge Lurie, with simultaneous conception reduction to practice, really just recognized what's true probably in all invention, right? Which is you don't know what you've got till you've got it, right? What a partner I used to work with called the Yogi Berra theory of invention. Because he's so focused on structure and chemicals, he said, well, you can't have it till you're at the end of the process. But the reality is you probably never do, whether you're talking about mechanical, electrical, or chemical. With regard to the question about rhetoric versus dualism, I think it's the same thing, right? I mean, because the discourse is the conceptual structure, and so if your rhetoric is set up in this way, then your practice is going to be set up in the same way. And I like your ideas about collectivism and so on. It seems to me that it's not so much that we're trying to grant a piece of the royalties to the student lab workers of the world, just to take a small example that Rochelle Dreyfus suggested to me, is there a reason that reputation might not be valuable, right? It may not be that you need a piece of the royalties, it may be that you just need your name on the patent, because that will either incentivize you to do better work, or that's really important to you in getting your next job or whatever. So there may be different interests at work here that could be accommodated by surfacing the invisible work.
All I was going to add in terms of the lab assistant example, it does parallel the way that we treat research assistants or editors. I mean, I think the thing that was interesting in the Childers case was that the whole rationale behind it is this is what we need to do in order to justify excluding editors from the title of author or research assistants from the title of author. So this tendency to individualize is also a tendency to hierarchize, and what you see is the concept of the dominant author emerging. So when you individualize, you say, okay, the dominant versus what? I guess the subordinate. And that's where we get the gendered reality of that dichotomy.
Two very quick questions. One each for Dan and for Karis. Dan, I wonder if I was intrigued by this idea, you brought up the idea of sort of the creative process in both patent and copyright as sort of conception or gestation or that
right.
Sort of biological metaphor. And I wonder if, and I sort of haven't really thought this question through completely, but whether there's a way in which copyright and patent are gendered differently in that respect, in that despite all the focus in copyright on the romantic author, authorship in copyright, at least as copyright law would have it, is not genetic, it's more claimed, right? It almost feels like paternity in that sense. You can accept it or reject it, or work for hire. It has nothing to do with actually who sort of gave birth to this thing. It's about who decides to claim paternity of that work for hire or even joint authorship. Whereas it seems to me maybe in patent, because of the requirement that the inventor must be named, is almost more of a sort of maternal connection. That's more of a genetic, it is the child because you saw it come out of that person's being.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I said, I wonder if in that sense perhaps they are gendered a bit differently in that respect. And then, Karis, just a quick question for you. I wonder, when you talk about authorship not being sort of the single unitary act, but this process of engagement and responding to texts that exist, whether your framework assumes a sort of ancestral text that goes back, you know, at the vanishing point to which all these texts are ultimately responding, and if so, if that text is gendered in some way, or if in fact it becomes this sort of network of responses that really has sort of no beginning or end.
That's interesting for a number of reasons, and we'll probably have to talk about this more during lunch because we need to break. But first of all, you might expect if it were gendered, it would be gendered the other direction, right? You know, because Patton is about utilitarian, functional, industrial kinds of things, and those are supposed to be really masculine, and you know, a lot of sweat and lifting heavy objects and things like that. And copyright is more aesthetic, and you would think that would be the one with the maternal connection. But it's interesting that you suggest that maybe it's not, and I think that's worth investigating. I know that there is a fascinating literature on the development of publishing, particularly in the UK, and the parallels between family law and copyright law at the time, you know, that a man's book was like his child, and his child was basically his slave, and you were allowed to make money off of your spouse and your child, and books should be really treated the same way. I think our history of patent is somewhat more nascent at this point. You know, we don't know as much about the origins of patent, but it's worth investigating, looking into to see whether there is a parallel, whether it developed in a different direction.
Just to be quick, first of all, on the comparative note in response to that question, it's funny how I think in Canada it's almost the other way around. So in patent law, it's kind of the race to the register still, versus in copyright law where there's the work for hire doctrine never removes authorship. So the author is always the author. The author retains the moral right. It's only ownership that is divorced from the author. And so it would be interesting in investigation to make that comparative. And then in terms of whether there's an original text, the beginning of the dialogue, in a sense, it's not the way that I conceive of it. I think even if there were such a thing, understanding it in its context means it itself is already animated by historical context and who the speaker was, and then the process moves from there. So the voices are always interanimating in that sense. It's a network, as you said, more than a process.
Wow, those were very concise and very rich answers, quick answers. So I want to thank you all for your questions and for your attention. And again, I want to thank the speakers. And after we congratulate them on excellent presentations, we'll break for lunch. Thank you.